This is a special report on the Hidden Killers podcast.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage of the Alex Murdaugh trial, day number two, cross-examination going on in the courtroom here on the 26th of January of 2023. Last we left off, lunch was taken, and now the trial continues. Let's go back to the courtroom.
Please be seated.
Anything before the jury comes?
Just very quickly, Your Honor, in conversation with Mr. Harpootlian, and as you're aware, one of the areas of that the state intends to go into at some point, subject to Your Honor's ruling, would be the events of what we call the side of the road, and that was the Salkehatchie Road events in September of 2021. We, of course, have talked with the defense and don't plan to go into that, as we've discussed with Your Honor, until they've had a chance to make whatever motions Your Honor has had a chance to rule. There may be SLED witnesses or other witnesses as we go forward that not only participated in the murder investigation, but also the side of the road investigation. And in discussion with Mr. Harpootlian, he's agreed that we can call those witnesses to discuss only the murder with the ability, with Your Honor's permission, to recall them later for the side of the road, in as much as Your Honor rules any of that relevant and admissible. And I just wanted to put that agreement on the record, Your Honor.
Mr. Harpootlian?
That's our agreement. I mean, Your Honor, only one further caveat. If he would make it clear when he calls the witness so that I don't inadvertently stumble into an area we don't want to, just if he just designate if you just say for limited purposes, that'll key me to stay away from asking questions that might result in me opening the door into the other area.
Certainly, and any such witness will be instructed what the subject matter is for that examination prior to it.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
You may bring the jury. Thank you. Your next witness.
Tanish Bryson Smith.
You come up here, please.
Thank you. Take a seat in the witness stand. State your name again for the record. Spell your last name.
First name Tanish, last name Bryson Smith, Bryson hyphen Smith.
Good afternoon, Ms. Bryson Smith.
Good afternoon.
Could you tell the jury where you work?
Hampton County E-911.
And how long have you worked for Hampton County E-911?
17 years.
And what is E-911?
Emergency Services Dispatch Center.
And what do you do there?
Currently, I am in a director position, just as stated in December. I am over the management of day-to-day operations of the 911 Dispatch Center for Hampton County, including budgeting, payroll, like I said, day-to-day operations, and record keeping, recordings, etc.
Okay. Does the Hampton County 911 keep records in the normal course of business?
We do.
And what kind of recordings are these?
We have audio recordings from 911 phone calls, administrative line phone calls, as well as radio recordings from our radios from the field.
Are all 911 calls recorded?
They are.
And how are these calls stored?
They're stored on our NextLog data recording systems.
How long are they stored for?
As long as we need them.
And who has access to those records?
I do.
Does anybody else?
No, ma'am.
Just you?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And how do you access the records?
There is a database in my office that I have to log into to access any recordings that is requested.
Okay. All right. Sometimes do calls from another county, such as Colleton County, come into Hampton County?
They do.
And why does that happen?
Cell phones pick up on the nearest PSAP based upon the location of that cell phone at the time of call. PSAP meaning Public Safety Answering System.
Okay. And why does it pick up on that, on the location, and send it to Hampton as opposed to Colleton?
Due to the geographical location of a phone call or a phone when that call is made, that cell phone picks up at that tower, and the tower, wherever the nearest PSAP is, is where that cell phone will be routed to.
And what do you do when you in Hampton County receive a call from Colleton that's supposed to be going to Collin County?
We transfer that call out to Collin County.
Okay. All right. Back on June 7th of 2021, did you receive a call from Alec Murdaugh?
We did.
And that call came into Hampton County, is that correct?
That's correct.
And what did happen to that call when it came in?
Once it was determined that the call was located, the location of the emergency was Colleton County, we transferred that call out to Colleton County.
And you determined the Colleton County location how?
Based upon the numerics and the address that was given. Once we plug that information into our system, it populates in Colleton County.
Let the record reflect, I'm showing the witness takes, what's marked as takes exhibit 9.
Okay, Your Honor.
State's Exhibit 9 is admitted without objection.
State's Exhibit 9 is a disc. Can you tell us what is on that disc?
The initial 911 call that came in on the night in question.
And how do you know that call is on that disc?
I was able to listen to it, and I dated it and initialed on the 23rd of January.
Your Honor, at this time the state would move Exhibit 9 into evidence.
Already been admitted without objection.
Thank you,
Hello? the line calling from 4147 Moselle Road. He's advising that his wife and child was shot. Mr. Murdoch, go ahead and call the caller.
Who is 4147 Moselle Road? I've been up to it now. It's bad.
How did they shoot? Did they shoot themselves?
Oh, no. Hell no.
Okay, and are they breathing?
No, ma'am.
Okay, you said it's your wife and your son?
My wife and my son.
Are they in a vehicle?
No, ma'am. They're on the ground out at my kennel.
The state has no further questions for this witness.
By the defense. Cross-examination.
Thank you for indulgence.
Just a couple of questions, Your Honor. So explain to me how this works. A call came into you in what county?
Hampton County.
Hampton County.
Correct.
And how, when you dial 911, how does it determine what county to send it to?
When you dial 911, the cell phone company picks up that it's a 911 call being placed. They hit the nearest cell phone tower, and based upon the location of that cell phone tower, is routed to the nearest PSAP, a public safety answering system.
Okay, so the nearest cell phone tower to Moselle
was Walterboro Highway Tower.
Okay. And you're from Hampton?
I am.
That's not you on the phone, is it?
No, sir.
Okay. Do you know the Murdochs, or do you know Alec Murdoch and his family?
Not too much, yes. I mean, a little bit, but...
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further?
Mayor.
You may step down. Thank you. I call your next witness.
Angela Stallings.
If you affirm the testimony about to give the court shall be the truth, so help you God.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Take a seat. State your name again for the record.
Angela Stallings, Stallings.
Hi, Captain Stallings.
Good afternoon.
Could you please tell the jury where you work?
I work at the Culloden County Sheriff's Office.
Okay. And how long have you worked there?
I have approximately 15 years with the Sheriff's Office.
What are some of your duties and responsibilities at the Sheriff's Office?
I am the administrative services captain. I oversee the 911 center. I'm over our civil process division, court security, our school resource officers, our sex offender registry division, training, supply, and the hiring process and records.
You have quite a lot of duties there.
Yes, ma'am.
In the course of your duties, do you keep records of 911 calls?
We do.
Can you explain to the jury what happens when a 911 call comes in to Culloden County?
Yes, ma'am. So when a call comes into Culloden County, it hits our recorder system. As soon as the call connects to the recorder and starts ringing, our recorder automatically starts recording automatically. It starts recording before we even answer the phone.
Okay. And is a recording of all 911 calls that come into Culloden County Center kept?
Yes, ma'am, they are.
And how are those records kept?
They're kept on our server that is the Carolina recording software system that we use.
Who has access to those records?
Myself and one other employee.
Is it normal for y'all to have calls routed from Hampton County to Colleton County?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And why does that happen?
Depending on the location of the call within the county, we border several counties. Depending on if it's a cell phone that is calling 911, depending on the closest available cell tower, it will hit that tower. Wherever that tower is located, it routes to that PSAP.
All right. On June 7th of 2021, did Colleton County receive a transferred 911 call from Hampton County?
Yes, ma'am, we did.
And what time did that call come in?
May I look at my notes?
Yes.
That call came in at 22:07:09, which is 10:07:09 p.m.
And the notes you're referencing up there, is that some kind of report that's generated when the call comes in, or what are you looking at?
Yes, ma'am. This is a report that's generated through our recorder software.
Okay. So you received a call from 10:07 p.m.?
Yes, ma'am.
Who was that call from?
Hampton County.
Okay. And who was the caller?
The caller was Alex Murdoch.
I'm showing you State's Exhibit 11. Do you recognize State's Exhibit 11?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
What is it?
It is a disc of the 911 call.
And how do you know that?
It has my initials and date that I reviewed it.
And this is a true and accurate depiction of the 911 call made by Alec Murdoch?
Yes, ma'am, that is.
Your Honor, this time I move State's Exhibit 11 into evidence.
Okay,
Your Honor. Submitted without objection.
Thank you, Your
The police are off on the outside.
feet from the road.
And Captain Collins, there's a break between parts in this call. Why is that?
The way our recorder system is set up, if there is a pause with either the call taker or the caller not talking, the recorder automatically cuts off. As soon as it starts to hear someone talking, it automatically kicks back on and starts recording.
Thank you, Captain Stallings. The state has no further questions.
Yes, ma'am.
No questions, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. You may step down. I call your next witness.
Barry McCoy.
Raise your right hand, left hand on the Bible. You swear affirm that the testimony you're about to give the court shall be the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Thank you. Take a seat in the witness stand. State your name again for the record.
Spell your last name.
Barry McCroy, McRoy.
Chief McCroy, could you please tell the jurors where you work?
Work for Colleton County Fire and Rescue.
And what is your position?
I'm the fire chief.
The fire chief of Colleton County Fire and Rescue?
That is correct.
And how long have you worked at Colleton County Fire and Rescue?
29 years.
And about how many scenes do you think you have responded to over the years?
I have no idea. Many thousand.
What are some of the training that you need to do to be a paramedic or respond with fire and rescue?
Well, that has changed greatly over the years, but presently, to be a paramedic, you have to have been an EMT for, we recommend, 2 years, which that's about a 500-hour course, and then you take a paramedic course, which is about 1,500 hours. In Colleton County, we require people to be cross-trained, so they have a 500-hour firefighter course as well.
And are you yourself a paramedic?
I am.
And how long have you been a paramedic?
Since 1981.
What are the would be the normal procedures when responding to a gunshot, to treat gunshot wounds or to a shooting?
Well, when initially respond, the law enforcement that's responsible for that jurisdiction typically clears the scene to make sure that it's safe for the other responders. When we arrive, we want to evaluate the patients to make sure that if they've got some injuries that we can treat, we treat them, and we transport them to the closest trauma center.
So if someone has been shot, what would you normally do to initially treat that person?
Well, we would control their bleeding, protect their airway, get them transported as quickly as possible. It may involve starting IVs. In Colleton County, we carry blood, so we could administer blood to the patient if they required it.
Okay. Did you respond to Moselle Road on June 7th of 2021?
I did.
And tell us about what you did when you got there.
I was on my way home from work, and I heard the sheriff's department on their radio dispatch units to the address in question, and they advised that there was two people shot. Shortly thereafter, they dispatched fire rescue units, and we have a standard protocol of what they send. There were multiple patients, so they dispatched two ambulances and put a helicopter on standby, and then a supervisor is also dispatched. We also send the closest fire station, which in that case was the one from Islington. I responded from Walterboro, and I did arrive ahead of everybody else. Dispatch had told us not to go onto the scene, so I staged about the 3900 block. And a few minutes later, a deputy passed me, and I went in behind the deputy, which was Mr. Green that y'all listened to earlier.
And what did you see when you were driving onto the scene?
It was really dark. The had a long dirt driveway, and when we arrived, there was some kennels off to the left, and like a big barn with a three-lane lean-to on the right-hand side.
Going to show you what's been marked. It states exhibits 51, 49, 24, and 21. just ask you to take a look at these pictures and tell me, are you familiar with those pictures?
Yes, ma'am. This does appear to be the accident scene.
And these are true and accurate depictions of the crime scene that night?
Yes, ma'am.
Your Honor, this time I would move states 51, 49, 24, and 21 into evidence, with states exhibits 24 and 51 being sealed with the agreed upon place holders.
No objection.
They're admitted without objection.
So, Chief McCroy, could you tell us how you observed the victims when you got to the scene?
Deputy Green went through the scene first. He actually drove a little ways in between the kennels and the lean-to. It was very dark, so he needed his headlights to see what was going on there. There was animals in the kennels. I don't know how many, but there was also some chickens fluttering around on the equipment on the right-hand side. The body of a younger male subject was face down by the kennels. He had some very severe injuries to the head. And there was a female subject at the end of the lean-to. She was also face down with severe injuries to her head. And there was a gentleman standing off a little distance away from it, and he was on a cell phone and seemed very upset.
Did you recognize that gentleman?
Yes, ma'am.
And who was that?
Alex Murdoch.
And how did you recognize him?
I have met him in the past on a professional basis because we have had to do depositions and such with his law firm.
Exhibit 21. Can you describe what the jury is looking at in this picture?
On the left-hand side of the photograph is the covered body of Paul Murdoch, and the down towards the end of the lean-to is you can see the covered body of Miss Maggie Murdoch.
And those bodies appear to be covered with pink sheets?
Yes, ma'am.
Now, were those sheets there when you got there?
No, ma'am. We got those off the ambulance and covered up the bodies.
And why did you do that?
Well, we typically do it to, you know, to shield the bodies from the view of the public. There were a lot of people showing up there. The family was on the scene, and you know, people just really don't need to see that.
Exhibit 24. Please describe what the jury's viewing.
That is the body of Paul, and he is laying face down at the entrance to, there's like a little utility room at the kennels. He is laying down with, you can see there's substantial damage to his head with a lot of blood around his head and what appeared to be his brain down there around his ankles.
And this is how you found Paul?
That is correct.
Okay. And you said that appears to be his brain down there by his foot?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And at this point, did you check his pulse?
I did not check his pulse. He and his mother both had injuries that we consider incompatible with life. There was a lot of coagulation there where the blood had congealed, and they were not currently bleeding, which would indicate they did not have a heartbeat. And obviously with his type of injuries, he, you know, is not any way you could sustain his life.
And this takes exhibit 51.
That is Miss Maggie. And she also had severe injuries to her head. You can also see the congealed blood around the bottom where her face is, and she had a hole in her head to where you could actually see inside of her head cavity.
Was it necessary to check Mrs. Murdoch's pulse or perform any life-saving treatment?
No, ma'am. And she also had injuries that were not sustainable.
And takes exhibit 49. That's just where?
That's the lean-to, and that's Miss Maggie's body in front of the little side-by-side.
Okay. Thank you. I have no further questions for this witness at this time.
Cross-examination.
Just one moment. Chief of the Coffee County Fire Rescue, correct?
That is correct.
And you, in the past, have been dealing with Alec Murdaugh in a professional capacity with his law firm, correct?
That is correct.
So you recognized him and you've seen him before, correct?
Yes, sir.
Was his demeanor grieving, distraught, upset?
He seemed to be very upset, yes, sir.
Very upset. Now, I've got just a very few questions for you. But when you responded, and I'm going to try to get the picture, I think. Here we go. This is that good. So, do you recognize this from the night of June 7th?
That is correct.
And those headlights facing us, are those the headlights from the Suburban?
That would be a vehicle that was south of the location, so the police car would have been north.
Right, but is that Mr. Murdaugh's vehicle, or do you know?
I have no idea.
Okay. So you, when you got there, you indicated to somebody that they needed to preserve some
And the consideration of charges in this case, as well as the understanding on the part of the family that premature release of the video could compromise.
And, I mean, how did you come to see those? Did you drive? You drove in off of Moselle Road, correct?
I drove in off of Moselle Road. The deputy parked in this little driveway here between the two, the kennel and the lean-to.
Right.
I parked at the end of the lean-to. Where I was at, I activated my scene lights, which are all the way across the front of the light bar.
The scene lights? They're high-intensity lights.
High-intensity, bright, white lights.
Okay.
So it was very dark, and I could see the tire tracks over to the right.
So as we look at this view,
they're not visible in this picture.
I understand that, okay. But would the area you were be to the
right?
This side or the other side?
Other side.
Okay, over to this side.
That is correct.
And on the other side of the shed, right here.
More to the bottom.
More to the bottom.
To the right.
So let me, maybe we have a video of this. It'll be a little easier for you to look at. No signal. Let my television at home. Okay, so as you look at, stop it one second. No, I'll go back the other way. Okay, back it up a little bit. From this perspective, can you see that perspective right there?
Yes, sir. The
Hold on.
If you back up just a little bit.
Back it up.
But if you'll stop it there.
Go back.
You can see the workshop on the left.
How about do this? How about step down here for us? So we all are singing from the same sheet of music. If you stand over that way so these jurors can see.
There's a workshop right here.
Uh-huh.
And there's a row here, uh-huh. A row here, and a row here. This row is where the tire tracks were.
And the crime scene is where?
Right here's where this Maggie's body is and that's Paul's body.
Okay. And how far is it from where you saw those tire tracks to where their bodies were, approximately?
20 or 30 feet.
20 or 30 feet. And you saw, now this was gravel, grass, dirt.
It's kind of sandy.
Sandy, but distinct tire tracks.
Yes, sir. Like one pair of tire tracks.
One pair. Okay. And you couldn't tell which direction they were going in? Or
you did not? Could have been coming in, could have been going out.
You're not a tire expert, are you?
No, sir.
Track. Okay. Go ahead and have a seat.
Thank you.
So, whose attention did you bring that to?
Brought it to attention of one of the deputies. I don't recall which one.
Was it Green? Deputy Green?
I don't recall.
But one of the Colleton County deputies?
Yes, sir.
And you indicated to him that it needed to be preserved, needed to be roped off, needed what?
I showed them to him and told him, I said, hey, there's some tire tracks over there. We tried to block off the driveway. I had one of our units stay out on Moselle Road, but a lot of vehicles kept driving around them. There was civilian vehicles kept coming in, and then it began raining, so at that point it...
So after you told... He didn't put any yellow tape up to block it?
No, sir. They had yellow tape in front of our vehicles where we were parked, but they didn't put any yellow tape down there.
And vehicles drove around your vehicle and just drove up and down that road?
Yes, sir.
Destroying the tire track?
Well, the ones that were on the road part, not the ones under the shed.
Okay. But to your knowledge, while you were there, did anybody take any pictures of those tire tracks?
I have no idea, no, sir.
Okay. Did you see any other pieces of forensic evidence, if you will, while you were there, other than tire tracks?
There were shell casings around Miss Maggie's body.
Okay. Now, did you go over and examine Paul's body?
Yes, sir.
Did you go in the feed room?
No, sir.
Okay. Were you very careful around the body?
Yes, sir. And the Sheriff's Department started putting up the yellow tape, and as they did that we backed up and got behind it.
We'll take the court's indulgence. We need to go to another.
No, it's right
here. Okay, watch. It's just video, and then I need to ask you. Is this the area you were talking about where there were tire tracks?
They're over to the left.
I'm sorry?
They're over to the left.
Okay, but all these vehicles that are parked up there?
That's the driveway coming in.
Okay. And then you're saying after that is where these tire tracks were?
Yes, sir, over to the left of this police car. You can see my vehicle was the red and white Tahoe.
Right.
Maybe 15 feet to the left of that was where the tire tracks were.
And you pointed those out to the Colleton County Sheriff's Deputy, said they needed to be preserved.
I just showed them to them. I didn't tell them what to do with them.
Thank you. No further questions.
Redirect.
Can I go to the state, Your Honor?
Thank you, sir. You may step
down. Thank you, Your Honor.
call your next witness.
State calls Jason Chapman.
Thank you.
Thank you. The lights on, or are they turning up? Back on or halfway or
Do you affirm the testimony about the other court shall be the truth, so help you God?
I do, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank
Take
you.
A seat in the witness stand. State your name again for the record.
Yes, ma'am.
Spell your last name.
Good afternoon. My name is Jason Walker Chapman, last name C-H-A-P-M-A-N.
Mr. Chapman, Jason, you state your name for the record. Thank you. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up, and what education did you obtain?
Sure. I'm a native, born in Walterboro. I've lived here most of my life. Graduated from what was Walterboro High School at the time. I attended the College of Charleston and the University of South Carolina, Salkehatchee, before starting my career in law enforcement. I actually joined the cadet program well before age of 21, then became a reserve deputy, dispatcher, and then a class one officer. And I've now been doing law enforcement. I'm in my 26th year.
26th year career. Would you walk us through how you first got, when you first got into law enforcement and kind of the roles you've taken on and the training you've done in that?
Certainly. In 97, I attended a reserve officer class. It was a joint class between the Collins County Sheriff's Office and the Walterboro Police Department. I had to actually wait until I turned 21 to take the final exam, went down to the academy, took the exam, passed, began working as a reserve. I then got hired as a dispatcher at the Walterboro Police Department, where I worked a short stint as a dispatcher to fill in a hole. And in the spring of 98, I attended the South Carolina Criminal Justice Academy. I graduated later that year. I actually graduated as a distinguished graduate from the academy. Since then, I've been doing law enforcement. I did my first 16 years with the city of Walterboro, and I transferred over to the sheriff's office January 1 of 2013, where I have remained since then. My training has, I've worked through pretty much every division there is in law enforcement, probably with the exception of civil process. I have an extensive background in firearms. I'm a firearms instructor, less than lethal instructor, active shooter instructor. I've had training as a narcotics supervisor. I've been through schools for administration, pretty much everything.
What's your current rank with the Sheriff's Department?
Currently as captain.
And how would you describe your responsibilities presently?
So currently I oversee special operations. That includes our investigative division, our tactical team, search and rescue.
Have you ever had an opportunity to testify as an expert in a trial?
I have.
Tell us about that.
This past year in 2022, I testified in federal court in Charleston, South Carolina, on a case involving the city of Beaufort. And I was sworn in as a expert witness in general police procedures.
I'm going to direct your attention back to the date of June 7, 2021. Are you familiar with that day?
Yes, sir.
What was your role with the sheriff's office back on that date?
The same as it is currently.
Supervising investigations?
That's correct.
Now would include, would that include homicides?
Yes, sir.
All right. Did you have an opportunity? Were you dispatched or were you noticed of an incident that occurred on that day?
I was. I actually heard the call and went in service before I was dispatched, but yes, sir.
All right. What did you hear over the radio?
Call coming out that a transfer from Hampton County had been received, in which the caller was reporting that his wife and child had been shot.
Did you know a location at that point?
I was given the location by dispatch, but I was not familiar at the time of the dispatch as to the parties involved.
And at that point, did you decide that you were going to go to the scene?
I did, sir.
What was the dispatch location?
I believe it was, I think it's 4142 Moselle Road in Arlington.
Were you made aware of who this involved?
I was not at the time.
Is 4147 Moselle Road within the limits of Colleton County?
It is, sir.
And walk us through what you did that night upon, you know, learning of this incident and then making your way out there. Walk us through that process, if you would.
Yes, sir. I had a brief conversation with Sheriff Hill by telephone while en route. He had been advised of the caller's identity as Mr. Alex Murdoch. With my career, I'm familiar with the Murdoch family and Mr. Murdoch. And Sheriff Hill advised me that if it was in fact confirmed to be Mr. Murdoch, that he would likely notify SLED simply because of the conflict of interest with the family. And shortly before we arrived, I believe he was able to confirm that. And that call was made to request for assistance from SLED and to request that they actually assume primary in the investigation.
Does your department, the sheriff's office, do you all work fairly closely with SLED? Is that a common thing?
We do, sir.
All right. Describe that process. I mean, not including this particular investigation, but just in general, how have you all worked with SLED as a law enforcement agency?
As far as crime scenes, like response to crime scenes, my division works, well, the entire agency, but we work very well with SLED. The remote location, although we have a satellite office for SLED here in Colleton County, actually, for the Low Country, their crime scene unit still comes out of Columbia. So, Millville Night, when they're notified that we may need assistance, or in this case, that we wanted to take them to take primary in the investigation, even with the fact that they're emergency services, it's still going to be about an average of a two-hour response for that crime scene unit once they're notified. So it's very common for us to begin the investigative process at that scene while we're waiting for their arrival, with them working jointly with us. And that investigative process usually begins with the acquisition of a search warrant, which we know will be required once the crime scene team arrives on scene. And that just comes from a long supported tradition of us working well together and obviously being capable to do so.
As a captain and as a supervisor of the investigations, do you typically wear a body-worn camera?
I do have one. That particular night, I did not have it. It's on my my exterior ballistic vest, and the scene was secure prior to my arrival, which so I did not have my vest on.
On arrival at the scene, were you made aware, did you become aware of who in your department had already arrived?
I was listening to the radio so that I knew that several patrol units had arrived prior to myself. And I believe myself, the sheriff, and one other detective arrived probably about 10, 12, 13 minutes after the initial officers.
Do you remember the rough approximate time that you arrived on scene?
I want to say it was around 10:35, 10:37 p.m. that evening.
Walk us through what you observed upon arrival.
Sure. So while en route, I reminded the shift supervisor, Sergeant Daniel Green, that to try to maintain the integrity of the scene as best as possible. I wasn't there, so I didn't know the magnitude of the scene. I don't know what he has, but just reminding him, limit personnel inside the scene, do what we can to preserve. Sheriff Hill came across the radio. I was trying to pull the weather up in this particular area I was driving through. I did not have much phone signal, so he did, and realized that we had an approaching storm that was about 45 minutes out. So he advised over the radio, once he got his phone to pick it up, that we needed to secure a tent. I had not been there yet. He was requesting the tent to place over the deceased bodies of the two victims. I relayed that information to one of my lieutenants that was en route. I also turned one of my detectives around that has the longest drive in which is Detective Rutland, and I informed her to head to the office to start working on a search warrant.
Is that your common practice?
Yes, sir.
Kind of, you spoke before about you all conducted joint investigations with SLED. Is it common for, well, describe for us what your roles might be in a joint investigation and what SLED's role might be and how that, you know, played out in this case.
Certainly. So the very first thing, obviously, is a notification for request for assistance and then the explanation of what exactly we're requesting. A lot of times our assistance is, what's requested is nothing more than assistance with the crime scene. Sometimes it may be that we're asking for them to take the entire case. In this case, the notification was made by the sheriff. All I was told was that SLED was responding, that they were sending a team of investigators as well as crime scene. Knowing that crime scene was en route, we went ahead and secured that search warrant. That's why Detective Rutland was turned around and sent directly to the office to go ahead and initiate that process. Obviously, at 10:30 at night, we knew that we were going to have to get the warrant typed, and then we're going to have to locate a judge in the middle of the evening. We wanted to have all of that done prior to the arrival of the crime scene unit.
You touched on earlier a little bit about the weather, but describe the weather as it was when you arrived that evening.
As I arrived, hot, sticky, I recorded in my notes. It's the only reason I can go back and tell you exactly, but what I have recorded in my notes is 79 degrees, 89% humidity, hot, sticky. It was not raining yet. An occasional raindrop on the windshield, but no actual rain yet. It was a little foggy on my ride in, but not foggy at the scene. And obviously evening hours.
And I think you mentioned before, but rain did set in at how long was it until the rain set in?
It wasn't very long. I think the radar was pretty accurate. I want to say within 45 minutes to an hour of that notification, the rain did come.
You mentioned setting up tents or requesting that tents be set up. What would be the purpose of those tents?
So in response to the crime scene, obviously preservation of any type of evidence is important. But the preservation is not always limited to leaving it there and taking a picture of it and wait for somebody else to get there. In this case, Mother Nature wasn't complying. We knew that the rain was inbound. So the tent was placed over victim Maggie's body in an attempt to preserve any evidence that may be there. I only had one at the time. Paul's body was positioned somewhat over an extending ledge that I was hopeful would keep some of the rain if it did start off of him. The other evidence would have been anything from, and at the time I didn't know what we were going to be facing, but from, you know, tire tread, footprints, shell casings, anything at all. So the intent would be to preserve that as best as possible. And if it was going to be affected by the approaching weather, do the best thing we could to mark it out, measure it out, and have that done or partially done by the time crime scene arrived.
As far as safety purposes, when you arrived on the scene, would you have considered the scene to be secured at that point?
I arrived pretty quick. I know that as far as the immediate, you know, right there, the area that I'm sure that you ladies and gentlemen have seen with the tape and the videos that were played earlier, the immediate scene, yes, the outside, you know, the property's approximately like 1,700 acres, and it's not just that property. It sits in the middle of nowhere. At the time, you know, we did not know what we had. I don't know if we had a active shooter, didn't know if we had a murder-suicide, didn't know if we had people in the woods. We don't have any idea. So inner perimeter secure, I would say yes, sir. Outside, you know, in the woods, across the street, I wasn't sure yet. I didn't know.
Is it fair to say that there was a lot of unknowns at that point when you first arrived?
A lot of unknowns when I first arrived. Very little known other than at the time what they had gotten as initial information from Mr. Murdoch and the fact that we had two deceased.
Tell the jury, if you will, well, first of all, let me ask you this. As part of your law enforcement training throughout the years, have you had any experience with or training in, you know, life-saving techniques, if needed, if someone were needed CPR or something like that? Are you trained in it?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And arrival on the scene, did you physically observe the two bodies that were present, both of Maggie and Paul?
I did, sir.
And in your estimation, was it clear to you that they were deceased?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Did you consider that life-saving techniques would be possible or would have any result?
I did not. Paramedics were there shortly before me. Got great fire rescue. I was assured that if there had been anything that could have been done, it would have been initiated prior to my arrival. But from what I saw, it was well beyond that.
Upon your arrival at the scene, were there anyone else present that were not either sheriff's office employees or employees of EMS and fire? Was there anyone else present on the scene?
The two victims, Mr. Murdoch and emergency services.
You mentioned Mr. Murdoch. Is that Alex Murdoch?
Yes, sir.
Is he present here today?
Yes, sir. He's seated at the defense table, blue blazer, white shirt, and glasses.
Did you have an opportunity to observe Mr. Murdoch that night?
I did, sir.
As part of your responsibilities there, what capacity were you there at the scene? In what capacity?
Again, investigative. I realized that, you know, we had notified SLED to take over, but again, what we were attempting to do and what we did do was identification of any potential evidence. We marked that potential evidence. If time had allowed, it would have been photographed. And then from that point, simply protected. Absolutely zero collection of anything was done by any of my staff, with the exception of one GSR kit that was instructed by SLED.
I know, have you familiarized yourself with the body-worn video of both Deputies Green and McDowell?
I did, sir.
And what was your first order of business upon arrival, particularly relating to Paul?
By the time I got there, they had placed a sheet over both of the victims. Something that, you know, I'm not always, I don't like. I understand that a lot of times it's placed there, you know, so the family doesn't have to see that, but prefer that it does not happen. But in this case, it is already there. And because the scene is still somewhat fluid, we talked about the inner perimeter being secure, but as reported by Mr. Murdoch, we don't know who the defendants are. We don't know where the shooters are. We see shell casings scattered around the ground that are obviously rifle casings. There's some evidence to support that at least one or more shots into Paul were from a shotgun. That means two weapons. So were there two people? Are there other people that may be injured? Inner perimeter may be considered secure, outer perimeter not so much. So we began really quick with an inspection of the two individuals to make sure that we had not missed a weapon or that the initial responding officers had not missed one. And we could see that Maggie...
I wasn't until you told
me. Apologize. We could see that Maggie, there was nothing laying beside her. We looked closely. Again, we didn't move her. So we went over to Paul, and I had a couple of the deputies there and a detective lift the sheet just so that we could look and make sure there wasn't a weapon underneath him. His hands were tucked, so you couldn't see underneath his body. But as best we could tell from the present state of the body, unless there was a weapon directly underneath him, there was nothing out to left or right.
All right, Kevin Chapman, I'm going to direct your focus to the monitor in front of you. I'm going to play what's been marked as State's Exhibit.
What's that? Oh, yeah, we need to be.
State's Exhibit number one.
Yes, sir.
Marked it to the 28-minute mark on that. Just looking at the still image right now, are you familiar with the scene there? And could you describe what's going on?
Yes, sir. So that's myself, Detective Tyndall, Chief McRoy from the Colleton County Fire Rescue. Lieutenant Lonnie Nettles in the background near the perimeter, inner perimeter tape. And victim Paul Murdoch's body to our left there in the open doorway to the feed room.
What are you preparing to do here?
At this point in time, double checking to see if there is a weapon. Yeah, I told you before we weren't sure whether we're talking about a full murder, a murder-suicide, active shooter scenario. Are there other suspects that may be in the woods? We knew we had the casings that matched to a rifle with some evidence to support a possibly a shotgun. So when asking if any other weapons had been found, everyone stated no. So I had them lift the sheet to make sure there wasn't the barrel of a gun or anything sticking out underneath the body.
A little bit about the scene here and your observations of what you're looking at. The kennels directly to the left, if I could direct your attention to those.
Yes, sir.
Did you notice animals in those kennels?
I believe in the one, two, three. There's a couple kennels closest to the feed room that did have dogs in them. And possibly one towards the end. They weren't all full, but the ones closest to the feed room, I think there was a dog in at least one or two of them.
Was the area wet?
The area directly in front of the feed room was like wet. There was also water that tailed out of at least the first two kennels. The rest of the sidewalk was not wet. This and that water, I never saw a hose, so I'm not sure if it was leaking from something, but it was actually standing water.
And was that water present consistent with the weather at the time?
No, sir. It hadn't rained yet. Not enough to leave anything. It was a drizzle here and there.
You observed the body of Paul. Was it physically wet as well?
For the clothing he was wearing?
He was saturated with obviously blood tissue. And his clothes did appear to be wet, but almost as if like absorbed from the ground up. Not saying that someone had sprayed him with a hose or anything.
Please observe the video if you would, and we'll have a few questions afterwards.
Hey, you want to close that in?
Sir? What's that?
You want to close it in?
Yeah.
So the guy
Did you direct Deputy McDowell into the feed room area to help with lifting of the sheet?
I did, sir.
And why would you do that?
I want the sheet lifted directly up, not drug across the body. again, I told you I'm not really a proponent of sheets, but it, since it was there, I would prefer that it be lifted straight up. I had already walked through to see what, if anything, right there. You can see I'm cautiously stepping there, but I'd already checked to see if we were going to be able to step to the inside of it, the spot right inside the inside the door frame. I had looked, and I felt like he would be able to step straight in, pick the sheet up, put the sheet back down, step back out.
And is preservation of a scene important?
It is important.
In your line of work?
Absolutely.
Is equally important securing the scene and
Gary Blood,
so you understand if there's any loose firearms around or that there's any other
uncontrolled
circumstances going on?
It is. Again, you know, the sole purpose of this right here is to help determine whether or not I have any suspects still on the move or if there's a weapon underneath him.
Thank you.
Fire rescue might have some more sheets we can steal.
That's right. It should be using about 5 feet. We all go for several areas.
Is this you looking for the gun?
It is, sir.
What do you notice about the body physically laid there, a Paul's body?
Feet towards the feed room, head towards the driveway, hands tucked underneath the body, fairly saturated in blood. Majority of the head is gone. There's a lot of tissue, what appears to be at least some of the brain or most of the brain lying on the opposite side from me to the victim. Wet, again, I'm assuming probably from soaking up rain or water, whatever that is, off the sidewalk, and a smartphone sitting on, propped up on the back of him.
Was Paul's person saturated in physical matter and blood?
Yes.
And his hands, were they accessible to anyone without... Could you have touched Paul's hands or wrists without physically moving him?
I can't actually see his hands at this point in time.
Fell down on top of him? Is that
they're underneath his body, yes, sir.
What did you observe that was laying on top of Paul's body right there?
Again, it was a smartphone.
Did you have a chance to examine that smartphone, get fairly close to it?
I got close to it. I didn't pick it up. I was present when it was actually collected later, but it was not collected at this point.
And later on, it was described the collection process that occurred after this.
It was collected by myself and Agent David Owens. I believe he's going to be your case agent. As far as collection of that, I stood by as a witness as he collected. He had on rubber gloves. It was picked up. He didn't actually do any manipulation of the device in front of me. It was bagged as evidence and placed in the vehicle.
Was the phone physically bloody?
I don't recall any blood or water on the phone. I'm not saying that microscopically there wasn't, but I don't recall from the naked eye seeing anything.
That's what I'm asking about.
No, sir.
From your observations, was it wet from either water or blood?
No, sir.
And when it was lifted off of Paul's shorts, did it leave like a mark of blood or water or anything like that?
Not that I recall, no, sir.
I haven't asked the dad about the phone, but the dad did say he came over and checked the pulses. Again, on that, I don't know what that's going to be.
He had a shotgun.
He did have a shotgun with him. I have secured that in the vehicle.
Were Were you able to locate a firearm underneath the body of Paul?
When the coroner's office arrived and the crime scene didn't, victim Paul was eventually moved, there was not a firearm underneath.
Are you familiar with the rifle round called 300 Blackout?
I am, sir.
Is that a, in your 26 years of experience, is that a caliber that you come across
with any frequency?
In the last couple of years, probably more than ever, but in all the crime scenes that I've worked, I believe this was, at the time, the second ever in my career that had a 300 Blackout as far as being involved in a homicide.
As supervisor on the scene, is it part of your responsibility and your duties to sort of direct what people do? You're the person in charge?
It is, sir.
Does that free you up to do other things? If you have your deputies doing the tasks that you've assigned them?
If possible, yes, sir, sometimes.
And on this particular instance and this night, were you able to observe Mr. Murdaugh and see what he was up to?
Oh, yes, sir, I spoke to him on a few occasions.
Whenever you're investigating a case, I'm going to ask you about items that you might designate as points that you need to address.
Yes, sir.
You describe what that might mean. What's in general like an investigative point or investigative cue that you need to focus on?
Anything that we hear or see that, based on the limited amount of knowledge we have at that particular point, just creates a unknown, something that may need further investigation, something that maybe doesn't necessarily correspond with the evidence on scene or with the statement made by somebody. It's something that just we need to follow up on. It can't just be left alone or accepted as fact.
What are some of the physical observations? I'm going to ask you about physical observations of Mr. Murdaugh. Did he appear to be, at least outwardly, did he appear to be upset?
Yes, sir, he did.
Were you close enough to observe whether or not he actually cried or had tears in his eyes?
He was upset, definitely upset. I got up to him, again, like I said, I spoke to him on at least two different occasions, and he was breathing hard. You know, his facial expressions were that of, torment. But did I physically see him crying? I did not. He was sweating, but he wasn't crying.
What did you observe about his clothing?
Clothing was clean. Didn't see anything that stuck out. And obviously no dirt or blood or anything that indicated he had been rolling around on the ground or that he had been involved or anything up to that point.
I'm going to ask you about something you do when you're arriving on a scene, particularly if it's a homicide. Do you have a practice of phoning or having a dispatch send you the 911 call?
Yes, we do.
Why would you do that?
We get a lot of information from 911 calls, more so than the average person, I think, would believe. And it's over the years, we've had several cases where had we not gone back and looked at that initial 911 call, we would have missed some very important information or information that could have cleared up some unknowns, those points of investigation you talked about much sooner. So in our investigative process, that's now one of the things that we try to do relatively quickly. In this case, with the scene being fluid and not knowing if we had suspects on the loose, I opted to go ahead and do that. And it took a minute for them to get caught up, as busy as they were, but they were able to get on the phone with me and play the 911 call for me.
So were you able to hear the 911 call?
I was.
And are you listening to that 911 call both for content but also critically and trying to examine the things that are said?
Oh, absolutely. We're listening for noises in the background, exactly what is said versus what we see, so forth.
So with that awareness of everything that was said on the 911 call, do you then take that information and apply it to the scene?
Yes, sir.
And are you applying that information to try to see if it checks out, to see if things are consistent with what you heard on the 911 call?
Yes, sir.
And on the 911 call, did Mr. Murdaugh indicate that he had tried to examine the bodies or check their pulses?
Yes, I believe dispatch stated, do not touch if you haven't. And Mr. Murdaugh replied that he had touched them, checking them.
To check and see if they're breathing?
And which would be expected, absolutely.
Upon examination, Mr. Murdaugh, did you have a chance to look at his hands?
I did talk to him, yes, sir.
Did you have a chance to look at his shirt?
I did.
And did you see any indication that there was any blood on any part of his body?
No, sir. Not again, just physically with my observations, no microscope. There, I did not see any blood anywhere.
And in your experience with viewing Paul's body, had you physically touched Paul, would there have been blood left on your hands?
Objection, Your Honor. Speculation.
Response.
Physically saw the body, and he cannot testify to the locations that would be touched and whether it would transfer.
Does he know what location he touched?
I'll lay a foundation.
I'll ask a few more questions.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chapman, going back to your experience in life-saving procedures, are there common areas that someone might touch to check the pulse if they were indicating their check breathing?
Objection, Your Honor. The question is, where did Mr. Murdaugh touch the body for a pulse? Was it the neck?
Objection. Overruled. The prosecutor is asking the question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Is there common areas that someone might check a body to check for, if they've indicated they're checking for breathing, are there common areas that someone might check?
No, I believe the most common is the neck and the wrist that you see that, you know, people with limited training would probably use. I'm sure there are others with medical training.
So the neck and the wrist. And please tell me where Paul's wrists were located when you discovered his body.
They're up underneath his body.
And was Paul's neck accessible? If his wrists were underneath his body, was his neck accessible?
I think you can get the portions of his neck. I don't know that you'd be able to get underneath. I mean, he's face down, and I didn't try to get a pulse, but where I know that you would check would be difficult without manipulating the body in some fashion, I guess.
And if you had to manipulate the body, and if you were going to try to check his pulse, be it wrists or neck, with what you saw that night, would your hands be bloody?
If I had attempted, they would have been, yes.
I'm going to ask you another investigative point that you observed. Did Mr. Murdaugh on the 911 call indicate he was going to retrieve a firearm?
Yes, sir. And that actually came out while I was en route as a caution from the dispatcher, but it was also present on the call when I monitored the call.
Having listened to the phone call, having listened to the 911 tape, what was your reaction, or what was your what was the cue that you were fixated on as it relates to the retrieval of the firearm? What is going through your head at that point?
Well, that he's scared. I mean, that he believes there may be somebody there, that possibly whoever he believes hurt them may come back and hurt him.
And sure, that's your estimation, right? That's what you're thinking.
So that's what I was thinking, yeah. I mean, and that's what I believe pretty much anybody would think. If he was there present with them and got spooked, and because I believe the verbiage on the 911 is, he states, I'm going to get a gun, that I don't feel safe. And dispatch tries to tell him, we would rather you not. And you know, he states again that I'm not going to show it to the officers. I'm not going to hurt anybody. I'll put it away, but I feel unsafe. So I understand that.
All right. Listen to the 911 call critically. What then did you observe towards the end after retrieving a firearm that you would cue on to in your investigative process?
After knowing that he had went and got the gun, knowing that he stated he was unsafe, and that he went and got the firearm, there, when he came back, as soon as he got back to the scene, the only thing I believe that was odd from that point was that he wanted to separate the call or cancel the call to call family prior to anyone's arrival. It was the only thing that just struck me as odd. Again, it's just a point of investigation. Up to that point in the phone call, he had asked repeatedly, where are they? Are y'all coming? Are y'all coming? Are y'all coming? I'm not safe. I'm going to go get a gun. And then when he got back to the scene, are y'all here yet? How far out are they? And then it was, I need to call my family, and the phone disconnected.
And when we refer to the scene is obviously, is that, does that uncover part of what was, you know, fenced off with crime scene tape? Does that, you know, when referring to a scene?
That would have been the primary scene, yes, sir.
But in your mind, what does the scene also entail? What other things?
Well, I mean, the only thing that the phone could potentially extend that scene, the phone call, excuse me, could potentially extend that scene. As far as entering a crime scene and not being able to introduce evidence, or exiting a crime scene without being able to take away evidence, and by his own admission, he left the scene, went to his house, and got a gun. Potentially, that could make the house an extension of the crime scene.
Because that's what he indicated on the phone call.
And that's what he indicated.
Is Mr. Murdoch considered part of that scene? The scene?
Of course. He's inside that area when we arrive, and, I mean, he would be factored into everything.
And then would that justify or explain why you might pay particular attention to him?
Sure. I mean, we would anybody that was there.
Now and I'm asking you this again, I know you've answered, but you've had a chance to review the body-worn camera from both Deputy Green and McDowell, correct?
Yes, sir.
Did your, after those videos cease recording because the crime scene had been secured, did you have an opportunity then to continue your investigation and continue your line of work?
We did.
And these activities would not have been captured on the video because it had been shut off. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Did you have an opportunity to physically observe, meaning watch, Mr. Murdoch, while your deputies and your officers were performing their tasks?
I did.
What were a couple of the things that you noticed that stuck out to you when physically observing Mr. Murdoch and how he was either behaving or what he was doing?
Again, I mean, he was emotional. Distress on his face. I didn't see him cry. Not everyone cries. I don't have an issue with that. There were times that when we got to certain places or asked certain questions that you could see a slight demeanor change or body language shift. And, you know, I took note of that, but again, just as a point of investigation. But he remained at the scene. He wasn't forced to stay. He was cooperative, but he did, you know, there were times that you could see reaction to different things.
Okay. Did you notice a reaction? Did you ever notice him tracking your movements or your officer's movements?
I know when I was there when I ordered Detective Farnado to take a GSR kit and explain that how the kit worked and why we were taking it, and he was very cooperative with giving the kit, and we really didn't have an issue there. Later, was looking at some, I wouldn't call them tire tracks, I'd call them tire impressions because there's no dirt there, it's just grass, but we noticed there was quite a bit of tire impressions that ran around the back side of the hangar.
And we'll get to the tire tracks in a second. You mentioned a term just a second ago called GSR.
Yes, sir.
If you wouldn't mind, could you explain to us just
sure.
What that is?
I apologize for that. So a gunshot residue kit is just a kit. We use specific kits provided by SLED because the kits are then sent off for testing, but it's meant to test for the presence of gunshot residue. They're very non-invasive. They have little ampules. You open up a sterile kit, put a set of gloves on, open the kit up, and you'll dab one of the sterile collectors around on the front and back of the hand of an individual, package those up, tape it off, seal it, date it, time it, case number, and then that's eventually sent off to SLED. We were asked, I spoke earlier and said the only thing that my detectives physically collected prior to SLED's crime scene's arrival was that GSR kit. It was done by us because there is a time limit on those, and you can't always wait. I know everybody sometimes thinks it's, well, why don't we just wait and do all this tomorrow, but GSR has a 6-hour limit on it, so we had to collect that night, and we did so And that's what I was referring to when I say GSR, is a gunshot residue test kit.
And Captain Chapman, related to the GSR retrieval, I know you mentioned that time limit, the expiring time limit. Is it your understanding that time, does that time limit refer to humans or just things in general, objects in general?
That refers to when we collect a GSR sample from an individual. That is our restriction from the SLED lab, is that it has to be collected within 6 hours of the estimated time of firing the weapon. And again, that kit's, I mean, it's just as much for any type of exculpatory as it is conviction. We use it a lot of times to exonerate someone as much as we would to convict.
Going back to Mr. Murdaugh's observations that you had, did he appear to fixate on one body or the other that were there?
Especially watching the camera footage, I didn't notice quite as much in person, but later scrutinizing the body cam footage, he does appear to fixate more on his son than his wife, but that's in that limited amount of body cam footage that I have.
All right, you mentioned before the tire tracks that you observed.
Yes, sir, or tire impressions.
Tire impressions.
Yes, okay. Sir.
Let's set the scene. Set the scene for us, if you would, please.
Sure.
Describing the grass, and we've heard a lot about, you know, there's rain, but moisture. Describe the scene, if you would, on that grass.
So if you come into the property and you go down the dirt road with Paul on your left, as you see in the picture before y'all, that gravel or dirt road between the kennels and the what's referred to as the airport or the airplane hangar eventually ends in grass, a large grass area that separates that hangar from another shed. And in that area is where Mr. Murdaugh's Suburban was parked with the flashers and the headlights were pointed towards Paul's body. But that entire area there is grass as opposed to the dirt or gravel lane between the two structures. And there's some very obvious, at that time, impressions in the grass, but they're not tracks like you think of that we could cast a track out of dirt, but you can't cast an impression that's in laid over wet grass from the dew. I mean, you're not going to be able to do anything with that other than to document it. And I did notice them, and I actually asked Mr. Murdaugh if he could tell me, because I was unaware of the body cam footage at the time, could you tell me what direction you came from? And he told me that he pointed and said he had come from the residence and pulled up here, turned around and went back the same route, confirming that the tracks around his vehicle, the Suburban, were his. And he said there should be two sets from where I arrived the first time, left and got the gun and came back. And I asked about the other sets that you could see. And there was one in particular that appeared to come close to Maggie's body, possibly. You had to have the light just right. And it just happened to be that I noticed it looking at the ground in front of Mr. Murdaugh's vehicle, because the lights were shining on Paul, that you could see that.
So the tire tracks, did you and Detective Rutland spend some time attempting to identify where those tracks could have come from?
We did try to follow them. One thing that started to bother me was that we didn't have a vehicle. We're trying to figure out how Maggie and Paul got to the kennels. It's a pretty substantial distance from the residence to the kennels, the property, you know, and I don't know an exact, but I'm guessing, you know, probably 1,000 yards from the kennels to the house. And it's 10 o'clock at night, so I don't know what time they got there, but it's a pretty long walk, especially if you're planning on walking back in the dark. And did they drive a vehicle? Did they drive a four-wheeler or a UTV or whatever, a golf cart? But we see Mr. Murdaugh's vehicle, and because he left it as instructed where it was, but we were trying to determine if any of these other tracks lined up with the position of any other vehicles that were on the property. There was a UTV with a flat tire. There was another a half-ton pickup in the shed across the grass portion from the hangar. Mm-hmm. I was thinking maybe those tracks would line up, or the impressions that were in the grass would line up with that vehicle.
Did they appear to line up with either of those vehicles?
They did not.
As part of your investigation, flash forward and just a little bit, did you operate and record two drone videos of the property?
I did.
And I'm going to show you. I hand you what's been marked as State's Exhibit 187 and 188. Briefly take a look at those two videos, DVDs, if you would, and let me know if you recognize them.
Yes, sir. Both of these discs I have marked as having previously viewed and confirmed their authenticity, one on the 25th of this month and one on the 26th of this month.
And these would be the drone video recordings?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Your Honor, we would move to admit these into evidence, I believe, without objection.
Any objection?
No, Your Honor.
You're admitted without objection, and ladies and gentlemen, we'll take a recess at this time. Please do not discuss it.
And that is where that segment of the trial took a brief recess and picks up again in our next segment here on the podcast feed in hour number 4. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any breaking updates and continued coverage of this case and many others here on the podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us for more continuing coverage.